Good evening, everybody. James McCanny with my Science Hour here for August 24th, 2019. A number of topics to cover tonight, including some new battery technologies. Let me first mention something about batteries, what we call a battery, the other term capacitor. They're somewhat interchangeable because batteries are basically a separation of charge by a chemical or other process. Capacitors, it's more of a physical separation of charge. For example, the separation of two plates. Those are the classic definitions of a battery and capacitor. But there's a real crossover. For example, if you look at the cells in a lithium-ion battery, and you could make an argument that those are really capacitors, and vice versa. So, and there's a lot of misunderstanding about capacitors and batteries and how they work. For example, there is a massive misconception about electricity in clouds, and meteorology is one of the bizarre fields, kind of like geology, in which, if you hear some background noise, by the way, it happens to be raining really hard where I'm at right now. And so there might be a little bit of humming, hissing noise in the background. But anyway, there's really a huge misconception about electricity in the atmosphere and where it comes from. If you read a standard textbook, get this. Okay, well, I'm going to compare this to a battery. The sunlight comes in, heats up the atmosphere, causes turbulence and tumultuous activity in the atmosphere, in which then clouds form magically. There's nobody that can really tell you how those form. I can, because they form because of electric fields, external electric fields. And by the way, that's what causes lightning to come out, to appear above the clouds and below the clouds. Getting back to the concept of a battery and clouds, the standard meteorological explanation is that clouds have this this kind of movement within, and somehow there's a separation of charge. And then as this builds up, it comes shooting out the bottom towards the Earth. Now, let me explain something. There's no battery on the planet that's going to, let's take a flashlight battery. I guarantee you, if you sat and watched that battery any amount of time, no charge is going to come shooting out the end of the battery. If there's a discharge of any kind, the absolute least path of resistance, and that's how real physical systems work. If there were a charge buildup within the cloud, then there would be an internal discharge within the cloud. That would be the path of least resistance, to try and get outside the cloud and then branch down to some other part of the cloud is absurd. It's just not the way it works. In fact, I was at a American Geophysical Union meeting one time, and I had a poster, and on the poster was a picture of a volcano going off. And I had these on my webpage, a picture of the volcanoes in South America at night. And the lightning was coming outside of the clouds, and it was quite a display. And so anyway, there was a PhD from NASA there, and there were some students there who I had been talking to. They were looking at it. And I was explaining that the electricity from this discharge comes from the ionosphere, and this is just a conduit. And that's why there's electricity and lightning outside of the clouds. So anyway, along comes this professor, and he gets rather disturbed at what I'm saying. And he goes, well, the lightning is created in the volcanic cloud. And the student came back and said to him, but it's outside the cloud. It's outside the volcanic plume, and therefore it could not come from inside the volcanic plume. I mean, the grad student understood this principle readily. And this is not, really isn't rocket science, but anybody that has more than freshman physics 101 or electricity and magnetism should be able to understand this very basic principle. But anyway, going back to clouds, they've actually gone up in airplanes inside of clouds to try and measure the electric field. And it is pretty much zero. There's no electric field inside the cloud. And this is also consistent with a conductor. Now, let's take a steel ball. Everybody could agree that that's a conductor. And let's put the steel ball in an electric field. Now, what's going to happen? The electrons, which are free to move in the metal, go to one side. They go to the positive side of the capacitor that's creating the external electric field, leaving the other side positively charged, and that would be on the side where the negative charge is on the external capacitor, so that the charge balances, and then you go inside the metal ball and the electric field is zero. So the free charge sets up basically a space charge sheath around the perimeter of the steel ball to create a field of zero inside. And that's what's going on in a cloud, because the cloud is in an external electric field. You can measure it. You can go outside. It's about 300 volts per meter. It's really big. And Tesla knew this. That's what he was doing. He was tapping into that field. But he realized that if you tap into the local electric field near the surface of the Earth, then you're not going to get much current. I mean, there's a lot of voltage there, but there's not a lot of available current. You got to get all the way up to the ionosphere, which is the source of the voltage. And then if you can drill a hole electrically through the atmosphere, that current will come charging through. And that's what creates the energy that powers hurricanes, tornadoes, and lightning in storms. It's energy from the ionosphere connecting through. But the reality of clouds is that the electric field inside the cloud is zero, and no, clouds do not create electricity internally because of tumultuous activity, and they are not a battery of themselves. They are a passer. They are a conduit. The same with volcanic plumes. The plume above an active volcano is a conduit. It's an electrical conduit. It's like a finger sticking up from the surface of the Earth. It's grounded because it's connected to the Earth, and it's like a finger sticking up, and it's then creates an electrical conduit for current to flow down from the ionosphere. And let me take another example that more of you can relate with. When we're talking about batteries and electrical currents in the atmosphere. And by the way, this is all described in my books, going back to my very early work. That's these concepts. But when a hurricane forms, you have a cloud buildup, and there's the reason there's a cloud buildup is actually because of the vertical electric field. And it's caused by the water droplets accumulating with a local, very weak electrical force. That's what holds clouds together. An extremely weak, it's called a van der Waals force. And it's basically a very weak dipole force due to imbalance in charges in the molecules that make up the cloud. Okay, so very weak forces, but enough to hold it together to give clouds their beautiful shapes. And of course, there's many different kinds of clouds. But that's not the cause of electric fields, nor is it the cause of lightning. Now, what was comical is when scientists, meteorologists first looked at clouds and knew about, of course, lightning coming out of the bottom of clouds. But then all of a sudden they discovered there was lightning above the clouds. So then you get into the quandary, how could you have lightning or electrical current shooting up out of the top of the cloud and out the bottom of the cloud out of a battery? This is absolutely impossible. And the graduate student that was at the American Geophysical Union meeting understood this. These are basic principles of electromagnetism. The inside a battery, there are electrical forces, and they are maintained. The charge is separated, and that separation is maintained by either a chemical composition. And when you take a wire or a load and you put it across the terminals of the battery, then current starts to flow, which activates the chemical process and creates current, frees the electrons, etc., which pass through the wire or through the load, and therefore you can retrieve the energy that's stored in the battery. Okay, so this is basic battery science 101. So technically, if you take a battery, any type of battery or supercapacitor, whatever, the one of the main primary components, one of the primary qualities of a battery is to maintain that separation of charge over a long period of time. In other words, it has a very high resistance. Clouds do not have high resistance. They have very low resistance internally. So there's no way you're going to build up a battery inside of a cloud. It's basically a conductor. So conductors do not make good batteries. Anyway, I'll be talking a little bit more about batteries. First, a couple other topics. Well, this is an announcement about the radio show for those of you who listen on shortwave. The summertime frequency is ending next week. It changes with the clocks, by the way. And so by next week's show, October 31st, wait a minute. 31st. Yes, it'll be October 31st. Will be on a frequency of 5.935. And this is explained on my webpage where it says how to listen, all the different ways of how to listen to my radio show. This is explained. But just make a note of that. Next week's show is going to change to the basically the nighttime frequency of 5.935 megahertz. This is only for WWCR and on the Thursday night live airing. So it does not affect the Friday night airing of the show or any of the other airings that occur during the weekend, the rebroadcast of the show, etc. So once again, starting with next week's show, the WWCR, this is the 6 p.m. Thursday evening show, will air on frequency 5.935 megahertz. Okay, and that will continue until next spring when the clocks change again, the daylight savings thing occurs, and then it'll switch back to the summertime frequency. And that's because my show just happens to be on the cusp of evening. And so now that we're moving into fall, we're moving into the, we're actually already into fall. September 21st is the first day of fall. And so we're already into the fall where the days are getting shorter every day. But they've set this change of frequency up to go along with the change in the daylight saving time thing. Okay, so just a quick mention here. I usually don't talk about politics. I try and stay away from them because we got a lot of turf to cover before the election next fall. But this past week was too good to pass up. Hillary Clinton got basically flushed out of the bushes, and she had been taking pot shots at candidates, especially one called Tulsi Gabbard. Now, Tulsi Gabbard is a second-term representative of a small constituency in the Hawaiian Islands. But she put a bid in for running for president, and she's going to be, from what I understand, in the fourth and last debate. She is qualified, whatever the qualifications are. But anyway, Tulsi Gabbard is getting kind of, well, in terms of the standard hardcore Democratic corporate-owned candidates like Hillary Clinton or the other ones, Tulsi Gabbard is getting a little mouthy. She wants to take back the Democratic Party for the people. What a concept. And so anyway, now they're accusing her, Hillary Clinton publicly accused her of being a Russian agent. Okay, well, gee, that story's getting wearing pretty thin. But just keep an eye out. I'll be following this a little more. But I've mentioned this before, that of all the Democrat candidates, she's the only one that seems to have a brain and has both feet planted on the ground and has a real message. But it's something to watch. I'm sure most of you have probably, if you watch alternative media or the regular media, you've probably seen some hoopla about that. But what's interesting, though, is for those of you who have not really been following this, Hillary Clinton has been out on the campaign trail trying to raise money, sell her books, and basically promoting herself as if she were going to be a candidate. So it turns out that this is my analysis, that when you watch the Democratic debates, they're out there just flailing with extreme left-wing liberal ideas. But what they're really doing, the Democratic debate, is to see who will be vice president candidate under Hillary Clinton's next run for presidency. And that's what's going on. Talk to anybody in the know that understands what's going in the background. You know, and Hillary Clinton, let me tell you, she is, she does not want to go to her grave until she has become president of the United States. You know, and she will claw. But the funny thing is, this Tulsi Gabbard woman is getting in her way, not buying the party line. Anyway, that's all I'll say about that. But just keep an eye out for that and into the future, because there's actually somebody that's not a corporate pawn and coming up as a dark horse. I mean, this is, there you got the Buttigieg, you got the mayor of Cleveland, or I don't know, different, pretty low-level politicians making a bid for the Democratic seat as a political candidate for 2020 presidential election. But she is, really a dark horse of the dark horses. You know, she might be the least, what most people would consider the least probable person to actually succeed. But she's pulling ahead. They're trying every trick in the book. They're trying to shut down her Google ads so that she can't make any money and then can't qualify. Anyway, this is quite a interesting thing to watch, because I don't remember I'm pretty old, I've been around the block a few times, but I don't ever recall a presidential candidate situation, either Democrat or Republican, quite like this. So anyway, just keep an eye on it. And if any other things break on that, I'll keep you letting you know. Also, an interesting result, Moody's election prediction showed Trump winning by a landslide based on economics, based on the question, will people vote for their pocketbook? And typically that's the bottom line, and the bottom line is that they will vote based on their well-being financially. And so what they predicted was a landslide, massive landslide victory for Trump in 2020. So anyway, for whatever that is worth. A quick note on PG&E. This week, the Wall Street Journal reported that PG&E is saying that it could be 10 years before distribution stability occurs, and that they could pull the power on millions of people in California at any time. What they're doing is getting ready for people to move to the city, and they're basing this on the risk of fires. And I'll just take you back a number of months, about a year, where the PG&E fires last year in California, there was a study, there was an independent study group that went out to see what actually caused these fires. And they came to the determination that it was some woman with a home-rigged, jerry-rigged electrical system that started the fires. And PG&E came running into court saying, no, it was us. It was really us, even though they had no proof of it. And, of course, there's ample evidence that the fires were set by professional arsons using all kinds of techniques, say laser satellites, aerial laser technology, all kinds of technology that would start these fires in California. So at any rate, and by the way, I had a little posting, and I still think it's true that they're trying to get these people off their land because of the uranium and thorium that's in California. So this is also priming the rest of you out there for electrical outages and higher electrical prices. And I've stated before that most power companies are near bankruptcy for many different reasons. Many of the power companies, because of their investment, or let's say bad investment, in nuclear power. Or with some of them, the investment into what you call alternative energy on a big scale that doesn't work. And so that will be passed on to the consumer. And if you don't believe that, just talk to somebody that lives in Ontario around the Great Lakes. They'll tell you how that works. Also, the reason for smart meters, so they can turn off your electricity or monitor or limit your electricity from a central location. Here's an interesting book that just came in, and I don't have the title right in front of me, but I think it's called The Google Archipelago. In other words, the back in the old, good old Stalin days in Russia, they had the Gulag. The Gulag was basically an outdoor prison where they took people that were dissenters. Dissenters were taken up to Siberia and put in labor camps where they probably just worked until they died. A lot of intellectuals, a lot of people that could understood what was going on. Anybody that disagreed with Stalin was taken off to the Gulag. Well, today the point of this book called the Google Archipelago is that archipelago, some people pronounce it that way, but the point of this book is that we are living in basically like the Matrix, same concept, but a little more overreaching, where Google owns YouTube. And so the censoring and the control of information that's going on is overbearing. And also, as it creeps in, it's already creeping in step by step. And let's take a look at something else, Amazon. Amazon is also, all of these companies are related to the CIA. The CIA owns these. They control them. They control information. And at some point, they will get it into place where the banks and correctness based on you can't have hate speech, and anything that's opposed to what the government says will be considered hate speech. So they're going to use this hate speech mantra to limit what people say in opposition to the government. So, and this is already happening. This is already going on in science, where they can give a Nobel Prize for a guy who predicted there was missing mass, which they've never found. They don't know what it consists of. They don't know any of its properties. They've never discovered it. They don't know how to discover it. But this guy was given a Nobel Prize for projecting missing mass. I just want to insert here that my peer-reviewed published paper, published in Astrophysics and Space Science peer-reviewed journal when I was at Cornell, showed that there was no need for missing mass, and I showed how the galactic arms work so that there is no need for missing mass. Now, that should be worthy of a Nobel Prize. If somebody can predict missing mass that doesn't exist, they've never found it, they can't detect it, they don't know how to define it, If somebody can win a Nobel Prize for that, certainly I should get a Nobel Prize for showing why you don't need this invisible, magical, missing mass. Okay, so at any rate, I'm not holding my breath, believe me. But back to the Gulag, the Google archipelago, the whole idea is that the clamps, the claws, the vice, the mental prison will be everywhere. And also they make the point that people will no longer have to log into the internet. It will be everywhere. You will not be able to, and this literally goes back to the biblical prediction, forecast, whatever you want to call it, prophecy, that in the end days you would not be able to buy, sell, or trade without the number imprinted in your forehead. Well, boys and girls, I'd say we're there. I'd say we're marching on the doorstep right now. And, you can look at your political wins, etc., whether it's in the United States or other countries. But all of this is going on in the background. And like the World Bank, it overreaches all of the international boundaries. So I think we're heading into some very sketchy times here. And, the ability of people to voice disapproval is going to be limited. There's a fight going on right now. But, I would say a high percentage of the public is not aware of everything that's going on. Just a quick comment here on new battery technologies. The listener sent this in. It's not really new battery technology, but I had mentioned this previous weeks. I've been talking about battery technology. And I made the comment that isn't it rather rare that the batteries that we use today, the lithium ion or the iron, I'm sorry, the lead acid or the gel batteries, which also have a lead core, isn't it odd that the metal in these batteries just happens to be the heaviest readily available metal known to man, lead? It's, you couldn't find anything more, of abundance that's heavier. So anyway, this guy in England came along with a battery that's based on aluminum. And it's very similar technology where you take an aluminum, you could just say an aluminum structure, you put an electrolyte with it, and that creates a battery. So you have, actually, the old Edison battery was very similar, where you had nickel-lead terminals in a solution that was very similar to seawater. And let me just go back and talk about one of the more basic batteries in existence, the seawater battery, something that allegedly was used in the old continent of Atlantis. And apparently around the world there have been found big, they're like rock or cement casks with wires leading out of them up and away up to a land-based area. But seawater is an electrically active medium. And if you put, like, on a boat, let's say you've got a boat with bronze bolts in it. Say you have a wooden boat, and it has bronze fastenings, and then somewhere else in the boat it might have some stainless steel bolts that hold the keel on or something like that. And then you have maybe a lead keel. So these are metals with different surface potentials. And so what happens is the seawater acts as the conduit for electrical current, and it sets up currents, and it actually will peel off the metal from one of these sources and deposit it on the other. And so to combat this, what people do is they will take a zinc, which is lowest on the electrical potential scale of metals. They'll take a big chunk of zinc in a, and it looks like a half of a tear shape, a teardrop cut in half, and then you bolt this on the side of your boat. And you have to replace these because all of the metals will eat away that zinc before they eat away the other metallic components on the boat that are underwater. So, and if you forget to replace that zinc plug that's under the water, then the electrolysis is set up between the other types of metals and it starts eating away the metals. I have personally seen boats where the guy will come in to dry dock to see what's going on with his boat. It's starting to leak up through the keel area or something, and all of the keel bolts are simply missing. That they're simply gone because of this electrolysis process. And so that's a battery. That's a battery that's something that will cause electricity to flow. And simply because of the varying types of metals. And so that's the basis of the Edison battery, the original Edison battery. And it's very interesting. I've seen these batteries. I have a picture. I think it's in my Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book. I have a picture of a Edison battery that was used on the railroad. And they had many of these in a container, and they were used for switching rails. They were used for turning lights on. This is back in the very early days of rail. And they had two terminals and plates that stuck down into the solution. And interestingly enough, when Edison patented this, he, of course, could not patent seawater, which is basically salt, sodium chloride, and other minerals, etc. But primarily sodium chloride was the primary salt that was in the water, in solution in the water. So he patented, I believe it was potassium chloride, just a step up on the periodic table. So he could patent that. He could not patent seawater, sodium chloride with water. So the patent and the Edison battery actually uses a solution that's just as readily available as salt from seawater. And the way they sent these out is they didn't have to ship the water because any place has water or distilled water. And so they'd send out a little packet of powder. And so when the battery was discharged, you'd throw the liquid out and you could just throw it on the side of the tracks. It was non-polluting. Fill it up with water, throw in the envelope of powder, put the lid back on, and you had a battery again, fully charged. And that's what they used. That's the original Edison battery. And, of course, with a water base. Now, so that's the same principle as seawater, a seawater battery. And, okay, so getting back to the idea, this person came up with an aluminum battery with an electrolyte that would then interact with the aluminum to produce an electric field and an electric current. And there are a couple issues with this. First of all, aluminum is one of the most readily available metals on planet Earth. It is really widely abundant, so it's really readily available. It's inexpensive. It's lightweight. When you compare it to lead, it weighs a lot less. So the amount of weight for your battery is a lot less. The amount of storage of energy, apparently, this is the claim, is much higher per unit of weight. And so it's a much lighter battery. It can carry a lot more charge. And so what are we doing? We're getting up to the point where these could power airplanes. Automobiles, weight is an issue. But here's the issue with electric automobiles. When you accelerate, you're expending energy. But when you brake, instead of using just friction brakes like on a regular car, you use the electromagnetic motors in reverse, and you then put that charge back into the batteries. So there's some loss. Of course, there's always loss in any process, but it's a more efficient way of operating. So weight in a car, you have to accelerate that weight to get up to speed. But then when you brake, that weight then helps put that charge back into the battery. So weight is not that big an issue with automobiles. And then once you're up to speed, all you're dealing with there is wind resistance in an automobile. And so there again, weight actually gives you a nice smooth ride. A very light automobile would accelerate faster with an electric car. But then there's not a big advantage to having a very light car. You're not going to go that much farther with an electric car that's a lot lighter. So they make electric cars the same as they do gas cars. They make them relatively heavy. The only thing with a gas car is when you brake, you're using friction brakes, and all that energy is lost. Goes into heat and goes into the atmosphere and also goes to wear down your brake pads that you got to replace every now and then. Okay, so back to the aluminum battery. So this could, apparently this guy's had a lot of trouble getting it funded, recognized, etc. But we'll see where this goes. There's, any technology, there are always questions of mass production. Can it be mass produced? These things I've had to go through with the wing generator. Can it be mass produced? Yes. Can it be scaled up to run big things? Yes. How big of things? The wing generator can replace nuclear and coal power plants, because it can scale. Three-blade wind turbines and solar cannot scale. They don't scale very well at all. Back to the idea of batteries. With any technology, in fact, I announced this last week or 2 weeks ago, that the Nobel Prize in chemistry this year, very aptly applied Nobel Prize, one I give 100% agreement, two thumbs up, to three men who were made instrumental discoveries in lithium battery technology so that we have lithium batteries today. And, of course, lithium batteries have their problems, like the cobalt issue, where if they melt down, that cobalt goes into the atmosphere and it's highly polluting. And other issues, just the melting down process, the internal discharge itself, which makes them extremely dangerous. They've caused fires in airplanes and also in suitcases. And a young man was killed because he put his telephone under his pillow while he was charging it, listening to music. Late at night, he put it under his pillow, and of course, the heat could not get out. It overheated, exploded, and killed the young man. So don't. There are things you don't do with the old, AA, AAA batteries. You could put your radio under a pillow, and it wouldn't be a problem. Lithium ion, while it's charging, you cannot do that. It's got to get rid of that heat. Pick up your phone sometime when it's charging. You'll see what I mean. It was the apparent cause of the boat fire on that dive boat that burned up, with killing 30 guests and a bunch of crew members. So at any rate, the battery technology is something that there's many, many factors. It's not a clear-cut issue. If you can make a little battery on a table, that doesn't mean you can mass produce it and have it as a viable product for airplanes and buses and other things. The hope is always there, but there again, it may take some ingenious people to solve those little problems to get it to a manufacturable, marketable product. I'm going to jump topics here a little bit and ask the question, what if energy became very inexpensive? This would be a world foreign to anything that you're familiar with or that your parents or grandparents were familiar with. You would have to go back to the 1800s, literally, to find an economy that was not based on energy. Back in the 1800s, there was energy. You had horses, you had mules, you had oxen, you had other forms of power, you might call it, but you did not have organized energy, nor was there the sale, organized sale of energy. And so ever since literally the early 1900s, when people bought hook, line, and sinker into electricity, it was something that, you know, improved people's lives, allowed them to work at night with lighting that was reliable, trying to study by using candlelight was not actually too productive, but electricity allowed all kinds of machines, like printing presses, like heating, like fans, like ducts, like you know, all of the appliances that you commonly use today. Electricity became made improved life tremendously, but there was a cost to it, a very dire cost. And as energy became more available, then the cost went up proportionately, and energy became a part of almost everything. So to the point where, say, you buy a hot dog at a baseball game today, especially if you're at the World Series, a hot dog, I don't know what a hot dog costs, but very expensive. But most of the expense of that, if you take, imagine a hot dog at a stadium. Okay, the stadium has its pound of flesh it needs out of that hot dog. The overhead to run the stadium, the employees, the cleanup crew, pensions, the physical construction of the stadium. Then you have the teams, you have the royalties, and, you know, each one of these entities has its energy consumption footprint. And so by the time you pay for that $8 hot dog, let's say, about 3 cents of that actually is hot dog, bun, and mustard. And the rest of that is going to other entities. And all of those entities, one of the major line items in their existence, even though they don't know it, even though it's probably not visible, is energy. Energy for people to get to the stadium, energy for the people to live in their houses, the people that are work at the stadium, the sports announcers, the, you know, all of these people, energy is a major cost in their lives, and they all need a piece of that hot dog for this whole operation to function properly. So the energy is hidden in just about everything we do today. If you drive your car, the energy to make the car, to mine the ore, to if it's recycled steel, to recycle it, to smelt it, to purify it, to get it back to a grade of steel that you can make automobiles with, the list goes on and on. So energy is a part of just about everything. And you could make a case, and I'm just going to pick a number that's probably near realistic. I would say 98% of the cost of everything around you is related to energy, the 98% of the cost. So if you're sitting there at your desk and you have paper, if you have computers, if you have of electronics, if you have pens, if you have a chair that you're sitting on or a desk, and you look at the energy that went into producing all of this, probably about 98% of the cost of everything comes back to energy. So what if we could live in a world that had extremely low price energy? Now, remember when Tesla was doing his studies back in the early 1900s, late 1800s actually, that's how far back this goes, he understood the issue of extracting energy from the air. And he really didn't know where that other end of the capacitor was. He just knew it was up there someplace. And he knew that the vertical electric field was about 300 volts per meter, extremely high. He knew that he could not extract much current from that vertical electric field because the source of the voltage was not local. It was up very high. And there again, he did not know the edge of space. He had no way of measuring it. He had no way of understanding. Tesla was probably one of the few people that understood that as the atmosphere thinned out up above and the dynamics of air pressure, etc., that there was a vacuum of space, and he probably could have guessed that it was probably between 50 and 100 miles up, you know, just as a round estimate. So he knew that to get to the current, which is current has to flow for power to develop, and so he knew he had to get up to that height, that altitude. And so when he designed the Wardenclyffe Tower, he knew that he had to basically drill through the atmosphere using a alternating electric field and a lot of power, because basically what you're doing is flipping the dipoles, the inherent dipoles in the atmosphere, in the molecules in the atmosphere, flipping them back and forth in unison and basically breaking down the dielectric. The reason the dielectric works, the dielectric properties of the atmosphere, is because the atoms are in a gas and they're random and they're moving around, and they prevent they're a good medium for a capacitor, and that's what he knew we were dealing with. Okay, so the Tesla understood this, but he was funded by J.P. Morgan. I've talked about this before. And Morgan realized, also Westinghouse. In fact, there's apparently a new movie about this. I'm sure it's full of really a lot of disinformation about Tesla. I forget the name, but there's a new movie coming out. I'll have to do some commentary on that. And then, like I say, there's so much misinformation about Tesla. What he was doing was extracting energy from the atmosphere, from the that comes from the ionosphere. That's what drives hurricanes. That's what drives tornadoes. That's what drives electricity in the clouds. The lightning that comes above and below cloud systems. That's all driven from the vertical electric field, which is ground is one side of the capacitor, and the ionosphere is the other side of the capacitor. And so the end result is that Tesla understood this, but the point I'm making here is that when Morgan and Westinghouse and those guys came in that were financing Tesla's projects, when they found out what he was doing, they came in and shut him down. They tore down the Wardenclyffe Tower with the bogus claim that if the Germans got to New York, this is during World War One. If they got to New York, they would come and get this technology and take it away, and it'd be advanced technology. So at any rate, and then there's the bogus information about Tesla is that he was using this to transmit power. Well, the question, it begs the question, where was he getting the power to transmit? Because he already had sold his technology, generator and grid system technology to Westinghouse, with a non-compete agreement. The only thing that he didn't sign for non-compete agreement is the generation of electricity from the atmosphere. That was a totally different product. But anyway, the point is that Westinghouse, J.P. Morgan, and the boys, the banker boys, understood that energy was the future. Charging you, the public, energy was the future. And anybody that would come along to offer inexpensive energy from a natural source was not welcome. And so you might imagine that the wind generator would be not welcome. If you look at General Electric, Siemens, etc., these companies that are marketing the three-blade wind turbines, and also these central power companies, which sell you energy at a premium cost, by the way, which is going up and will go up, and as I said, with the PG&E deal, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Be prepared for your energy bill to skyrocket. It's going to go through the ceiling. But anyway, the point is that very early in this production of energy as a product, the powers that be realized that that was their ticket to ride forever. So the coal, the iron industry, reserve mining, also owned by J.P. Morgan, took over nefariously from the Mesabi brothers. That's a whole another story in itself, which I talk about. The reserve mining of minerals. These guys were positioning themselves, and now the same people are positioning themselves in front of water, and that's what the world climate change baloney is all about, is the control of water and natural resources that are required for your being, existence, for your well-being. And so this is just getting you up to the point where energy is being sold as a product. They realized very early on that it was all about the money. But let's get back to the idea. By the way, when I was working on Tesla technology, which is something I rediscovered, this is back in the when I published my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, the technology for the rediscovery of what Tesla was actually doing, I published in that book, and then in my weather book, The Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, I expand on that, what Tesla was really doing. But in my research and trying to replicate what Tesla was doing, I realized that what he was doing was a very bad idea on a big scale. Back in the early 1900s, New York City was about the size of, let's say, some minor city in the United States today. And, of course, today, with the vast amount of power we're using, et cetera, the use of vertical electric field current and capturing it with Wardenclyffe Tower type of towers is an extremely bad idea. It would be environmentally horrific. And plus, there's no way to control it when we have solar storms. So using that type of technology to garner energy is a very bad idea. So what I turned to was wind, because the same electric currents that come from the sun every day build up the wind on this planet. And talk about a renewable resource, wind is the ultimate renewable resource. The sun only shines a couple hours of day during the day. The sunlight is a terrible source of renewable energy, because only a couple hours of the day, and if it's raining or whatever during the nighttime, it doesn't work. Wind is blowing all the time. And if you look around the world, the net sum total of energy around the world is constant with respect to wind, not solar. Okay, so anyway, and that wind is renewed every day because of the electrical currents that drive our weather systems that come from the sun, very powerful weather systems. So wind is the source of energy that is free, not vertical electric field, not the ionosphere, as Tesla was trying to do, which he succeeded in doing, by the way, before they tore down the Wardenclyffe Tower and defunded his Colorado Springs project. He was successful. He was lighting up lights all over the Southwest Desert in Colorado Springs. He blew out a local power station generator, which he had to pay for because of the success he was having in running the currents underground, not through the atmosphere, but in the ground. He had the resonance frequency of the ground. He understood that. But there's no way to control it. And so what Tesla was doing was very innovative, but not practical on a large scale. Okay, so anyway, getting back to wind and the cost of energy. So if you take energy as you see it today, the coal cars, the mining of coal, the railroad trains, the storage, the big generator plant that burns the coal, turns it to steam, the immense amount of heat going into the atmosphere, or nuclear, the nuclear processing, the vast amount of reagent that have to be destroyed to get nuclear fuel. People are trying to tell you now that nuclear is a green source of energy. It is not. It is the worst polluting, most environmentally damaging source of energy on the planet. But that was the plan all along with General Electric, to put out a three-blade wind turbine that did not work, and after 15 or 20 years, when the public finally woke up that, hey, this crap won't work, it won't solve the energy problem, then, doggone it, we got to go back to nuclear. That's what's going on today. I just saw another video. Some clown getting on there telling you how wind and solar won't work, so we, doggone it, we got to get back to that clean nuclear power. Oh, man, are you people being sold a bill of goods out there? Unbelievable. Okay, so anyway, what if, in the economic sense, you go back to having extremely low-cost energy? That hot dog at the park, at the ballpark, instead of $8, would now be about 20 cents because everybody's electric and energy base, their footprint, would go down extremely, down tremendously. And the same for natural gas or nuclear. The cost of those energies to build the power plants, good grief, this Hinkley power plant in UK, up to something like $38 billion to build a 1 gigawatt power plant. Absolute insanity, and it'll probably never see, it'll probably never generate a watt of electricity. Boy, are those people being taken to the cleaners. Okay, so anyway, imagine a world in which energy was literally almost free. The people like Joe Biden and Hunter Biden would actually have to go out and get a real job. You know, the energy industries would that really control the world would fade away overnight. And the grip that this has on the public would go away. Third world countries would finally be able to have their own energy source and not dependent on the colossal political machines that manage energy. The World Bank, its main hold on the world, besides fiat money, is energy. They're in control of the energy and now water. So at any rate, just a little discussion here on what would happen if we had extremely inexpensive energy from a natural source. Like I said, the wind is renewed every day from electric currents, electrical currents, literally, in the solar system around planet Earth as we discharge the solar capacitor. So why do you think they don't want my work out there? Well, it bites right into the heart of the energy and water industries. Anyway, about out of time here for today. Remember my webpage, 15% off on water filters, water filter elements. No need for add-on filters and free shipping to the 48 states. My paid cast and the wing generators available all on my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.